Project doing another episode of Monster in a Glass. Tonight, we're going to be red. All red, because we're doing the communist. Pinko commies everywhere. That's what this is all about.
I'm even wearing red underwear, I think, just for this episode.
That's fantastic. That's our researcher, Mr. Jason Cruz.
Yeah.
It even has a hammer and sickle on it.
Nice.
Is that, like, at the opening? Is that... Which is the hammer?
It's just a sickle that you got on zip it. Here's the hammer, baby.
Yeah.
We're also joined by Professor.
Professor.
Nick Layman.
That's right. Hello, hello, hello.
So we're doing the communist. When I first saw the name, I was kind of shocked, given that all of these cocktails come around usually pre-prohibition. Maybe some of them are after prohibition, but at that time, communism... not popular. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting because who makes a cocktail named the Communist and why are they making it? And what's
assholes.
It
about? Yeah.
All the people hadn't tried it yet.
Communism?
The cocktail.
Yeah.
It's got orange juice. It's communism for, now with vitamins.
That's right. The big red C.
Big red C.
Okay, so Jason, what did you find out about where this cocktail comes from, what it's about?
So this is an interesting one because, you know, we've done other ones where it seems sort of a one-off. There, you know, you look at it and you're like, well, there's got to be, you know, the name The Communist, it should stand out. There should be other books that have this, but it really sort of is limited to one source, which Ted Haig actually puts this recipe out there and he names the book. It's called... and I would hesitate to call it a book. He calls it a pamphlet, and I would say that's pretty close to being true. It's like...
cocktail pamphlet?
It's like 20 pages, maybe. Put out in 1933, so right after Prohibition, and it's called Cocktail Parade. And the cover of the book is drawings of some butler whose name is clearly Jeeves. I mean, just by looking at him, you know he's British. He's the stereotypical British butler, and he's serving drinks off a cart to... fancy men and ladies in tuxes and evening gowns.
How subversive. It's all red, too. That back, the background.
I know, right? But it's a parade. It's a cocktail parade.
They're trying to march you right into
so it's red line. It was funny when I... Yeah. Here's your communist. Mm-hmm. Now get in the bread line.
Now get in the line.
I look at this cover and I'm like, oh, yeah. I know who this was aimed at. This probably wasn't a book that was written by a bartender... mm-hmm. For the purposes of compiling...
do you know who wrote it?
It doesn't have an author, actually. So that's another reason it was just published. And huh. Which, you know, right after Prohibition...
it just appeared magically? That's like what the devil does.
Right.
It's like, suddenly a book appears. It has no author, it has no...
Cameron, it appeared from the masses. It didn't.
Yeah, pamphlet. It just suddenly littered a square
one man. There is no... No, this is pretty common. Especially things like this where it's like a pamphlet. They're clearly just trying to make money. So it probably had an author or somebody compiling it, but it's not attributed to anybody. It's just, it was published by Canopy Parade from Scarborough, New York in 1933.
Okay.
Time Life.
So pretty much. I mean, yeah. That's essentially what it is. They're clearly cashing in. It's like, we need to get this out. It's clearly aimed
at... people are drinking again.
Right, yeah. It's clearly aimed at a certain crust. So, you know, you have a lot of books that we go over a lot, like PGD. Patrick Gavin Duffy's book comes out in 34. There's a couple others that come out in 33 and 35.
So wait, this one beat Patrick Gavin Duffy's?
By a year.
That's interesting, because I've always thought of his as being like... oh my God, let's get a book out now.
Yeah, drop right. on the scene.
You know, well, I mean, like, so this was came designed out first. They didn't even have time to have an author. They're like,
yeah, no author.
Screw
20
that.
Pages.
We just need drinking.
I mean, and that's the thing.
Recipes, damn it.
Put stuff on pages and print it.
Well, and that's the weird thing is like, then I go, well, they must have gotten this drink from somewhere because clearly it's the only place that it shows up. I can't find this drink anywhere else in any other book. So it's like, they just came up with some drink. The other things in there, and I think it has, like, the standards, like the Manhattan and the popular ones. And then it's like, and then try this one that we just made up here. So the recipe for this is gin, orange juice, cherry brandy. Haig calls for cherry brandy. But actually, the recipe in the pamphlet calls for cherry bounce. And I'll explain what that is. And fresh lemon juice. So cherry bounce It's best known as an American cordial. And there was a note in this source that said it was made at all socioeconomic levels. I'm like, great. Ooh, it was affordable, I guess. But it seems to be...
It's the people's cordial. It's the
people, right. There you go. I mean, everything about this
it's
seems
red to be, like blood.
Well, right. And that's the thing, too, is like, it's clearly a red drink, which is probably why they called it the communist in the first place. But Cherry Bounce is similar to Cherry Brandy, only with Cherry Bounce, it's spiced. It's made a little differently. So... They made it in England in the 1700s, colonial America, they made Cherry Bounce. What they do is they cultivate sour cherries, crush them together with their pits, add sugar, alcohol of choice, I think typically brandy, and then they let the mixture basically ferment.
Aren't pits really bitter?
I think mean, so, I and I think that's the difference between cherry brandy, where they just take brandy and they let the cherries soak in it and sort of steep, rather than mixing in the sugar and the alcohol and letting it ferment. So they, and it says sometimes they added like nutmeg and cinnamon. So it sounds like a very warm.
It's like drinking potpourri.
Right. I was reading this one thing where they said Cherry Bounce was often indistinguishable from Cherry Brandy. It says, indeed, it is probable that the name Bounce was intended to foil tax collectors in the 18th and 19th centuries and in the early 20th century rural Maryland. One meaning of Bounce was to lie or swindle. And before its near synonymous association with cherries, Bounce sometimes also referred to the fruit-flavored cordial as blackberry brandy, and to an 18th century combination of spruce beer and wine drunk by some New Hampshire fishermen. So it's like, wow, that's a lot of weird things. So I found recipes for Cherry Bounce, like how to make it. And one comes from a book by the Daughters of the American Revolution. It's a book of beverages being recipes secured from those housewives most notable for their skill in the preparation of choice and delectable beverages for winter nights and summer noons. And that's why I love old book titles. Actually, to say...
Pure poetry right there. Holy shit. Yeah,
it's made with whiskey, not brandy. Even if you use cherry brandy instead of Cherry Bounce, that's even older. I was finding recipes back to the early 1700s for cherry brandy. And just even mentions of it, like in 1711, an account of the trade in India. So, like I said, you couldn't find any drinks by this name, couldn't find this recipe anywhere else. I found a couple recipes that were similar that called for orange juice, cherry brandy, gin, and Dubonnet, called a wedding bell, and a Dubonnet fizz, which was orange, lemon, cherry brandy, and Dubonnet. As far as I can tell, it's the first and only place that this shows up.
Wow.
Not too much to go on with this. You know, the ingredients, they're not too unique, but the name of the drink, it's kind of what really was interesting to me. It's like, clearly it's red, but they could have gone so many ways with it. I mean... It is the 30s, it's post-prohibition, it's depression era, there's a lot of talk about communists.
Communism, we all know what communism is, but I wanted to check it out, because...
Are you saying, Cameron, that you were checking out communism?
I was checking out communism.
Deleted. Deleted.
Yeah.
Goodbye, Cam!
Goodbye, Cam!
Is that a black van outside?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
I feel like I had a handle on it, but then I looked it up, and there's a whole lot more details.
When I think of it, honestly, I think of Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, okay.
Was it Rocky IV? Is that IV?
What
no, remember when he was going to break you?
Yeah.
I would break you.
Yeah. So communism in its most infant state is the kind of thing that happened with tribes. You know, like, you have fire, I have a pointed stick, together... We can kill something, and then we share the spoils. So it's a survival strategy. It wasn't unusual. So that's like the earliest form of communism, but it's not what we typically think of. Prior to communism, or separate from, really, communism in Europe and Russia, there were groups in the United States, like the Hopedale Community in 1842, set up by a Christian named Aidan Ballou. The whole idea there was a community of progressive thinkers and humanists come together to work in factories. They give all of their money and stuff to the community. Together, you work together and share everything, and everything is better that way. They ultimately went bankrupt and dissolved.
Because communism doesn't work.
Oh, God. I think that there is no fucking way that they could... I mean, you can't compete... You know, in a capitalist world.
Let's all share and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's also, yeah, I mean, I think it's, you're in a capitalist world, and it probably works on a very base level when you just have stuff and goods and services that everyone has their role. But when it's like, there's money, there's gonna be a guy at the top who's like, yeah, yeah, you keep doing that, mm-hmm. but you have to give me stuff so I can make sure I take care of all of you.
Here's the thing, is I think the Hopedale community probably was a purer form because it was relatively small. And I think Aiden Ballou is probably, you know, working from a genuine interest in having his experiment work. But it didn't work in the grand scheme of the entire society because they just got mobbed by all of the robber barons and other people who were manufacturing at a better rate, you know. Yeah. So, like, it wasn't going to work because of competition. I mean, those were all experiments. I find it kind of interesting that communism in the U.S. started or was experimented within the Christian community, that's where the progressives were, that's where people were thinking of communities like this. But when we think of communism in general, usually we think of Russia.
Well, for the layman out there, how does red get tied to communism? What's that history? To Wikipedia.
Really, the story starts essentially, I mean, you could go all the way back to the French Revolution.
That's what it says right here. They picked it from the French Revolution, and it was because of the blood of the workers who died.
Oh, is that...
That's what this says right here.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Okay, so the thing is that the French Revolution was the first time that... I mean, there had been revolts before in various countries where the peasantry rose up and killed some people, but usually they were quickly quashed, and it was over. And, you know, it was
nobody
back to...
Nobody lost their heads too much.
And it was the status quo. Even if they got rid of the current ruler, somebody else was put in place, and then it was another monarchy where people were oppressed. But in the French Revolution, this was the first time everything changed. Mm-hmm. And then it stuck. And it was, like, big. Yeah. It was like a major power had lost everything. And that made everybody kind of go, huh?
Whoa.
What?
Yeah.
And that excited all of the people.
Oh, shit, my dear.
Well, there was that, too. A big way.
Yeah.
So, like, all of these people who had no hope before were all of a sudden like, wow, we could actually make change happen. And that's when a lot of people started really thinking and writing and doing things that were more revolutionary. You know, because there was an example. It had worked somewhere. Now, I mean, you could question whether... you know, how well it worked, given how it turned out with Napoleon and all that. But, like...
and the hey-hey.
Yeah, yeah. But...
Oops.
And how much it changed Europe after that. But the fact that they overthrew the monarchy and made it a people's government...
That was new.
That's why Ireland, right after that, was like, it's our time.
Yeah, let's
it's our time. And then they even called on the French, and the French were like, hell yeah, we'll come and help you get the Brits out. And then... I think they were sending ships and a huge storm came, and France was like, storm, can't make it. And they were waiting there with basically like pikes, and the British were like, what are you doing? And they're like, nothing. Waiting for the French.
We're about to die.
And then it was like one of their many failed, but it was like, they were like, it's now. This is our time. This is when we have to make our move.
It's for
things
real.
Are changing,
wow. Yeah.
And we'll get everybody behind us.
The winds are changing.
But other people were like, "Wait, what's happening?"
And it was a firestorm in Europe. Yeah. Like this was really happening, and to some extent, like the whole coffee shop thing. Coffee came to Europe around the same time, and then coffee shops started opening up, and coffee was safe to drink because it was boiled water, and so you didn't have the contaminants. Prior to that, everybody had to drink alcohol. So for the first time, people were hanging out and not drunk. You know,
there
have been
thinking and stuff.
I know.
Yeah.
There have been
so they could remember.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
What it was.
Right.
There's been speculation that the rise of the coffee house really spurred on the revolutionary movements across Europe because not only were you not drunk, but you were also jacked up on coffee.
Yeah.
And you had no idea
making connections.
And you weren't thinking that the exultation I feel.
Yeah.
Isn't because I'm taking a drug.
Yeah.
It's because of revolution.
The change. The winds of change.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
dude,
yeah.
I feel great. This is wonderful. Let's cut off heads.
There's got to be a history through drugs. That's what there is. That's got to be out there somewhere.
I think that's kind of what we're doing.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty much history.
But, like, you know, if you're not aware that you're being manipulated,
yeah.
You know, chemically,
yeah.
Then you start to think other things. But in any case, that's speculation. That's something I've heard. I find the idea interesting. Mm-hmm. What isn't speculation is that Karl Marx published his Communist Manifesto in 1848. So Marx was a philosopher. He was really big into Hegel. Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, particularly the phenomenology of spirit, which Hegel wrote in 1807. And basically, Hegel's big theory was about history and how history evolves over time. And you start out with a way that people are living. It's called the thesis. So you start out with an idea, a system of government, say the Athenian democracy. You're going along and then something messes it up and you realize, oh, this doesn't work. Mm. So you go back, it's almost like a backlash, and you do the opposite.
So like a snap
and back. And that's called the antithesis.
Okay.
And the Spartans would be the antithesis. Compared to the Athenians, you have freedom, democracy. Well, that doesn't work, so we're going to become all about totalitarianism, rules and structure and
grow beards and get weird.
Yeah, exactly. So you have the thesis, and then you revert to the antithesis, but that doesn't work because that sucks too.
Yeah.
And so what people do then is they combine them, and you get the synthesis.
Find a balance.
And that carries you forward to the next step until that becomes the new thesis that is no longer working, and then there's an opposition to that, and then they combine, and you move forward. And that's the way, it's called the dialectic, the historical dialectic, and that's what he said history was doing.
Interesting.
That every stage was a thesis, antithesis, synthesis, and then forward motion.
So then revolution.
And that was
too
the
extreme.
Spirit of the world in history. Mm. And he was saying that this is how the spirit moves. And it was Marx's idea that communism was going to be the next synthesis. And so he made the point, you know, the intellectuals at the time were thinking about it and they kind of dug it. And plus they wanted it to happen because everybody's sick of
how the accepted what was the philosopher that came before Marx was the Hegel.
Hegel,
yeah.
Oh, he was huge. He was very big.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So it wasn't a big leap. And so for intellectuals and for people who are really into the idea, they ran with it. And it became really popular in Europe. Of course, it was still limited to academia to a large extent. You know, it was all theory. It was all just ideas. But it started to really gain a lot of traction during the Industrial Revolution because his ideas plugged directly into workers and workers' rights and how they relate to the work that they're doing. And about class, you have the people who own the factory versus the people working in the factory and that whole relationship. So you had a lot of people talking about that, but explaining that to the workers was definitely more challenging.
Yeah.
If you read in the late 19th century, you will start to see more and more things happening. Rulers of governments, kings and, you know, dukes and running for their lives in numerous occasions where there are revolutions and people like ambush them and stuff.
It's building on momentum because it happened before.
Yeah. And so you've already got the leadership in Europe kind of running scared to some extent. But where it really starts happening in Russia, that started in World War I. Now, this is something that I got from another podcast. Dan Carlin does this really awesome show. He had this massive thing about World War I.
What's the show? Plug it.
It's called Hardcore History.
I want to check
by
that.
Dan Carlin.
That's right.
It's amazing.
Right.
It's a really good show.
I want to check.
Just filled my head. But one of the things he talks about was how in World War I, Germany is really pressed because, you know, they're fighting the French on one side and they're fighting Russia on the other side. One of the things that you have to think about with Russia, and it's always been true, is that Russia is massive.
Huge. It's like
full
the biggest
people.
One.
There's so many fucking people.
You ever play Risk?
Yeah.
You're
exactly.
Doing all right. You got Russia.
And even if they didn't have the best technology, they had people to just throw
there you go.
Into a war.
When you think about what Russia is now, I mean, Russia itself is smaller. It was made up of all these other states and countries. And when you look at it now, at how different, it is always surprising to me how that even worked, where they were like, no, we're all Russia. And now it's like you have these countries and they're vastly different from like one country to the next. And you're like, but how did they just decide like, you're all Russia. You over there, you're Muslim,
so
but you're
massive.
Russian and you're Christian and you're more Arab, but you're,
okay.
You know, and it's like, but you're all Russian. How do you, I mean, like.
Do you know where that, okay, so there was a period in 1400s, I think. this relates a little bit later, but we can get into it now because you asked the question. Ivan III was a huge expansionist. He was one of the czars. He was one of the most popular ones, and he came to power.
I heard they found the Amber Room. On a side note, anyways, Ivan III. I just that What's came out of nowhere. Room? The Nazis. You don't know about that?
No.
Oh, it's cool. I'll send a link. Oh,
okay.
It's way cool. Completely stole an entire room made of amber from one of the palaces in Russia. Like, they disassembled it and stole it.
Wow.
Yeah, nuts. It's really cool.
That's, yeah.
Anywho, go ahead.
In the 1100s, 1200s, 1300s, that was when Genghis Khan and the Mongols basically overran all of Asia.
Yeah.
All the way to China, and they basically owned everything down into the Middle East. The Mongols were talking with the Crusaders when they were down there. There were instances of that happening. The Mongols were even encroaching into Europe on several occasions. They were monsters because they were really ruthless fighters. They were really good horse riders. It's been said that the Mongol armies could reasonably have competed with Napoleon's armies because of how fast they were and how skilled they were.
And the psychological, I mean, they were horrible.
And they were also really hard-bitten people because Russia sucked.
Yeah.
That whole part of the world is cold and nasty and horrible. And that's another thing that you have to think about Russia. Living in Russia back then sucked. So you had these people who basically took everything over. But then internally, they kind of dissolved because they had their power decentralized. All of them were broken up into different groups.
Yeah.
They were taken down by vices because they became severe alcoholics and such. As they took over the land, they started to get a lot more luxuries than they used to have.
So they literally dissolved internally.
Yes. They just melted into goo.
Goosh.
So basically, you have this gigantic piece of land that kind of becomes vacant.
Mm.
Ivan
kind
III,
of a power vacuum.
Yeah. Ivan III just went in and filled it up because Russia had a centralized government and it had organization. For the longest time, they were paying lip service to the Mongols. They were like, yes, Khan, we love you.
Yeah,
we'll do whatever.
We love your beard.
Because, you know, you would do horrible things to us if we didn't.
Yeah,
but,
right?
But after, you know...
Here's some women.
Yeah.
In a cart. Leave us alone.
But after the Mongols, Ivan just kind of went in and took over the land. That's how you have this massive chunk of land that they can just basically move into. Now, granted, because of what the Mongols did and how many people they killed and how much land they basically just ravaged, there isn't a lot of population at the time.
Mm.
There's a lot of space to grow it.
Mm.
And that's kind of what the Russians capitalize on.
And were they seen as liberators too because the Mongols were so bad? Is that kind of a unifying factor?
Well, the Mongols were in power for quite a long time.
Okay.
So, like...
Everybody was used to their shit.
Yeah, exactly. And by the time that they were falling apart, they were just as fat and lazy as any of the others.
And they threw wild parties, which, you know, if you don't die, it can be fun.
Fermented horse milk.
Holy
shit.
The kumis.
That's the shit.
Yeah.
So that's how Russia became this gigantic thing. Back to World War I. The Germans are hard-pressed. They're trying to win a war, and they figure that one of the things that they can do is... Living in Russia sucks for the average person. It's cold, miserable, and the government is oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
So they pull Lenin, who's an exile in Switzerland. They take him out of Switzerland and sneak him into Russia. And Lenin is a revolutionary, communist revolutionary, and he's an ardent spokesman for new thinking. And he moves right in and starts to talk to the workers. And before they know it, the Russians have a revolution on their hands.
Wow.
And that kind of fucks up their war effort.
From inside.
Of course, this also acts as a backlash as well. Because, you know, it's getting into the Russian military, Russian POWs... Then spread the word to the German soldiers, and now you have Germans passing the word, and it's creeping all over. So,
but by that time, I mean, in 1917, World War I is almost over. The U.S. has joined. So when did they put Lenin there?
The October Revolution was in 1917. So you're talking...
even if he did go in and he's spreading the word, and the revolution happens at that point. I mean, Germany's kind of fucked anyway. I mean, they're, you know, at that point in the war, they're, whether it destroyed their war, Russia's war efforts, does that even matter? I mean, because if Germany's at that point almost already done, it's really just more of an internal thing in Russia. They're just fucking up things.
Well, a couple years prior, it was any man's game. I mean, still, there were still people coming in. There were still...
Right.
There were still new players, and there were still things happening within the war that were like, holy shit. I guess the question is how much did it really affect the war effort? Maybe not all that much. I guess that's a question you could have, but it's how communism got to Russia. Because people weren't watching. They were fighting a war. The Tsar was busy with other shit. While he was fighting a war, communism was being legitimized within the working population.
You know what's funny is that's also the same time as, right around the same time as the Easter Rising in Ireland.
Really?
It was 1916. And they intentionally, the rebels, they were using World War I. They didn't side with the Germans, but they were basically telling the British, we're not going to fight your war. Mm. But while you're fighting your war, we're going to have this revolution. They actually were working with the Germans. They were trying to get weapons from Germany.
I believe it.
Because they were like, hey, the British are occupied. But again, like with the French in the 1790s, the French ships being blown off course by a storm, the British intercepted like a German sub or something. And they were like, hey, what's all this shit on here? Oh.
Again?
All these...
Again? God damn it.
It's like, Irish history is so fascinating in that way where you're like, everything, it comes down to one moment. You're like, this is it. This is going to be the one. And then everything gets fucked up. It's like, some guy forgot to, close the door, basically. You know, it's like, oops. And then, like, they were like, oh, we got your guns. And it still happened. It was successful. In a way, in a weird way. But it was around the same time period. They were using the same methods. It's like, hey, they're occupied.
Uh-huh.
This is...
And remember, same time, Mexico's going through a revolution too. Yeah. And there's actually Germans talking with the Mexicans as well.
You seen that Simpsons where they do Dublin right before they invented whiskey? And it's like Atlantis. Like, they got flying cars and shit. And computers and stuff. And then they're like, I just invented this drink. It's fantastic. And then 5 minutes later, fire, fighting, and they're like all beating each other up. It's really funny. That sucks.
That's how it was.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Because it was catching, I wonder if
they had the
revolutionary ideals were catching or if it was just...
Something else?
It had to be part of it. I mean, if you see what's happening in the other parts of the world. But I wonder how much of it, too, was that moment of opportunity of the World War where you're like, oh... Our oppressors are—they're doing something else. Let's bring this because you have like people who have been working on this for years and years and years and years and years, and it's like they've—it's always in their head, and it's like they're looking for the opportunities and seeing a war where it's involving all of these imperial powers.
Lenin was doing that. I mean, he was
right, but that's what I'm saying is like
the people he was talking to maybe didn't necessarily consider it. Maybe some people he explained it to, but
I'm wondering if it was the world seeing the rest of the world revolt, or if it was coincidence of people who were always looking for that opportunity and got that opportunity.
I think those people that enact change are the ones that have really good timing. Like, they just see it, you know what I mean?
Well, if you're always thinking about it,
the people who make history enacting change have good timing. Because how many people tried and we don't know about?
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Or we know of them as failed. I mean, like...
Or they're a footnote.
Well, and that's the weird thing is that in Ireland, it failed.
Uh-huh.
The revolt failed. But in the end, it succeeded because they executed...
They played the long game.
They're still playing the long game. They knew every one of those rebels that got caught.
Yeah.
The 16 that got caught, they executed... The people in Dublin were like... Fuck these people. They're disrupting everything. We're not getting paid. These stupid rebels. And then the minute they executed them, people were like, what the fuck? You can't execute our people. And they turned. And it was like, then they became heroes. So it worked in a weird way. Wow. It wasn't like...
Yeah, the martyr thing.
Right. It was such a bizarre way. And so, I mean, I'm sure you had a lot of that happening throughout the world.
Yeah. So communism is catching on.
Yes. And in Russia, people are excited. And
red wildfire.
Like
they
red
have,
wildfire.
They have... their slogan is peace, bread, and land. And peace, so bread, and land. The Bolsheviks gain some legitimacy as a political group and slowly move in. And it leads to the Russian Revolution, 1917 to 1922, where basically now you have the all-out fighting, just like we discussed in Mexico.
So that's not the slogan then. The peace thing was wrong.
Yeah.
It was like, it was this.
Well,
peace.
No,
bread. And bread. Yeah, bread. Well,
was, you're going to stand in line for bread. We know that will happen.
It was peace because everybody who would join.
I think they meant pieces.
Pieces.
Bread.
Well, it's the pieces other. It's the other people that were causing war.
Yeah.
If you just joined, then there'd be peace, right?
Right.
So the people who were actually fighting. There were two main groups, if you could call them that. The communists were the Red Army. Opposing them was the White Army.
So this is a chess match?
Kind of.
Nice.
The White Army were...
Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, kind of cool.
The anti-communists. They were essentially monarchistic. They wanted the status quo.
Yeah.
They liked the way things were.
Put it back.
And they actually were
we
saying...
We had stuff before.
It was cool.
Actually, they were like, let's bring back the times of Ivan III, which was what? 300 years prior, wow. It's like, yeah, let's go back 300
that far,
years.
That's how far it needs to go back.
That's their
cave, thatched roots cottages.
It's like, what?
Let's you know, bring back the Mongols.
So, yeah, remember those Mongols? They were funny.
And so what they had to offer the people was essentially, oh, let's go back to the way things were when it sucked for you. Mm. So that was their solution. They didn't really have a plan that was going to fight the new order. Mm. And basically, they got rolled all the way back up to over by Alaska.
Oh, wow.
And then kind of crushed up against there. There was also these other groups. They were referred to as the Green Army. And those were basically the peasants who lived in the countryside who didn't like the Bolsheviks coming in and taking their food, taking their animals, taking their people to fight in the army, killing them. So the problem with the Green Army was that they were... just peasants. They were decentralized. Yeah. And all that they were saying was, stop taking our shit.
We just want to farm, bitches.
Yeah, leave us alone. Stop taking our shit. But that wasn't going to fly. And initially, they were a problem for the Bolsheviks because they would kind of join together. They thought, yeah. Well, these people are rebelling, so we have to go crush them. But then they'd find all of a sudden that it wasn't just that area. It was all the areas around had joined to fight them.
Is it like a urban versus rural thing? Like, were the Bolsheviks industrial factory-working people and the farmers weren't? Like, how do you distinguish between the Green and the Red Army?
Yeah, I think that the further you got away from Europe and from Moscow, the more people were kind of separate from that.
Yeah.
And they had different lives, and it wasn't the same kind of situation.
Okay.
So
they were pretty much all right. They're like, there's nothing really bad going on.
Why are you coming here and taking our shit?
Right.
But then
I don't like communism because you just keep taking our stuff and don't give us anything.
Exactly. Like, how is that good for me?
They didn't have a way to fight because they didn't have a political platform.
Yeah.
They weren't centralized. And once the Bolsheviks were like, okay.
They're like, I got the bread right here, asshole. Go away.
It's more than...
It's
more than just a peasant revolt.
Yeah.
So we just have to go in with the army, not the police. Then they just wiped them out. So basically all the resistance was gone. Do you know what the estimates on mortality by 1934?
Pretty much everyone died, right?
Well, Mexican Revolution, it was what, 2 million?
I think 1 million.
1 to 2.
Was it?
Yeah, that's, I mean...
It was over a million.
It was hard to say. Death toll for the Russian Revolution, 7 to 12 million.
Oh, man. That is so many people.
I can't, like, that estimate doesn't... 7 or 12 million, I don't know.
There's a pretty large
somewhere in there.
Like,
yeah.
Maybe some people left.
But I guess
5 million people wandered off. Like, what?
They just went to Alaska, man. It was cool.
Yeah.
But I mean,
should I call you comrade, Mickey?
Yeah, exactly.
I bet those people probably...
I
mean,
tell you guys.
I bet you probably could lose 5 million people in Russia.
If
probably.
They're not written down and
there was no way
bread.
Of tracking any of that shit.
Yeah,
so.
It's pretty unlikely that the peasants were keeping genealogy.
Records. And...
Yeah. And then we're like, wait, no, I need to check in and make sure they know I'm not dead.
Right.
Okay. So, in addition to that, as they're becoming more established politically, their movement is sweeping across the world, called the Communist International, or Comintern, and that became established in 1919, and it scared the crap out of everybody around the world, because their goal was to unite the workers against governments. And that was the intended goal, the aim of
the Comintern. Yeah, you got a problem.
1921, things are starting to settle down more, things are getting a little bit more established. Russia is a communist state. Lenin declares something called the New Economic Policy, the NEP. And it was kind of like what happened in Mexico. It was a nationalistic attempt to wind down the revolution and bring Russia up, pump it up. And the thing about it is that it was an economic policy that was something more like what you see in Northern Europe now. So basically, you can own your own business, you can work your own way, you can make your own money, build the economy, grow the nation, and the government will take care of the railways and all of the municipal stuff. Mm. Lenin's saying, to some extent, I think that this is his new synthesis. Rather than swinging all the way over to this where everybody owns everything. It, the individual business people can have their own thing, and the government's going to support that by taking care of all of the state essentials. And so that was the new economic policy, and that was moving forward. Government would take over the banks, foreign trade, railroads, large industries, so like really big things. But then in 1928, Joseph Stalin said, fuck that. He took over and basically...
He probably literally did say that.
Well, yeah. And,
fuck these.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bitches.
Well,
he said, "I will crush you.
I will crush this crap."
he saw what he's. I'm sure he saw the value of having workers who did not get paid. They were just happy to be working for the state. Yeah. You know, that was their reward, was doing good for their nation.
Keep doing what you're doing. I'm going to oppress you now.
Yeah.
In 1937, Stalin did the purge.
Did he kill Lenin?
No, but when Lenin went, when Lenin died, I think that's when Stalin really made his move. And because he saw how revolutions happened, he got rid of all of the communist leadership. All of the people who were there when the Bolsheviks took over and staged a revolution in 1937 and the years after, he got rid of all of them. So there was no longer any
Because clearly opposition. They were trouble.
Well, yeah. And they were
going to... They caused problems for people.
And he also eliminated coffee, took it out. Can't have nobody drinking coffee and talking about stuff.
That was the Turks.
The Turks did that?
There was a Turkish leader who didn't like the way people acted when they were drinking coffee, and so he killed anybody he found in a coffee shop.
That would do it.
He had them beheaded, so.
Right then and there?
Yeah.
That would make me stop.
I don't need coffee that bad. Shit.
Chill. I'm going to the opium den.
Yeah, that's much better. Yeah. Lay down and suck your pipe.
There it is.
That's the...
Chase the dragon, you asshole.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
No coffee for you.
Yeah. So, in Europe, that's the story of communism. Right there. I can honestly say I didn't really know all of that. I didn't know anything about the Russian Revolution at all. In terms of, like, how the opposition rolled out and how easy it was for them to just go in and take over. Because nobody had a better answer. Nobody had a better solution. They're all like, go back to the way it was. It sucked. I mean, you're not presenting a new solution.
Right.
I mean, what do you expect?
Jesus. Here's our thought. Let's do things the way we used to do things when they were horrible. Right? Are you with me? Like, what kind of stupid shit is that? Good policy.
but I think that the Comintern really was the thing that made communism the big scary monster all around the world. Because they were basically saying, let's make the world communist. Let's get rid of all of these wealthy people in Europe and the Americas and, you know, and...
Well, I mean, you're right. It's a severe threat to the Industrial Revolution and the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
You just want people pushing buttons and moving levers. You don't want thinking.
Yeah. That's what it ended up being, because really the new economic policy that Lenin proposed was something much freer. It was a state that supported the nation to grow. When Lenin was out of the picture, Stalin could just go in and say, no, I think I'd rather have a slave state.
Yeah.
So.
And he killed anybody that disagreed.
So communism worked then, right? Is that what happened? I missed that last
That's
part.
What was it?
It was red and cherry flavored.
Oh, shit.
So in the U.S., I think that things were going well enough here. I mean, it wasn't cold and miserable everywhere in the United States.
We got the West Coast,
and
right?
people were free to make a lot of money.
I don't know what you're talking about. I got gold and sun. Yeah, I'm okay. I don't need communism. I own half this state. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, the Bolshevik Revolution was... It was a lot of things. I mean, again, it was timing. The U.S. has entered World War I. There is already anti-communist sentiment in the U.S. at this point. I mean, you had the Haymarket Riot. They were accused of being communists and anarchists. I don't know if they knew exactly what that meant. Anybody who was against communists or workers rising up. I don't know if there was a clear understanding of what a communist or an anarchist was. I was looking at this collection of, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century images of anarchists and communists. And this is, what's striking is the picture that they have in this book. What is this book called?
Cocktail Parade.
Next to the communist. The pamphlet is, you know, so on the cover with all the rich folk in their tuxedos and fancy dress and their butlers, the communist has a very shady character in a dark coat, a long beard, very strange, straight, long mustache, a hat. Like the
typical villain.
He looks dirty, he's holding one of those cartoon bombs. If you looked at the political cartoons of the time, that's what people thought. They were like, this is a communist.
But
if you see this guy, he's a communist.
But also...
he's going to bomb you.
He's also European.
Yeah. Oh,
most likely for sure. Eastern European.
Right. And actually, one of the men that were hung in the Haymarket Riot, after the bombing and the Haymarket Riot, one of the leaders who was speaking, he had nothing to do with the bombing, but his name was August something. He was German. But that was part of the reason. They're like, but he's German.
Yeah.
Clearly he bombed the shit out of those police. Mm-hmm. He's a communist and he's... He was a communist. I don't even know if he had a beard, but he was foreign, which, I mean, and that was kind of a lot of the sentiment from the, you know, at least the late 19th century that I could find up through the 40s, where it was always the same picture. You're like, who is this guy? But it was somebody who was foreign, possibly Jewish. A lot of the times they would say, well, they're Russian or they're Jewish. They're definitely foreign, and they hold bombs.
Also, do you know what else? They're likely Catholic.
Yep,
that's another thing. If they're not Catholic, then they're rationalists, and they're
the Catholic part of it was also part of the immigrant.
Yeah,
You know,
because
at this time you have a huge influx of people coming from Europe, so you do have a lot of, you know, Eastern European. You do have a lot of. And a lot of those Eastern European people are Jewish. And then you have a shitload of Irish who are all Catholic, and German who are Catholic, and they are also flooding, and Italian who are Catholic. And it's like, and it's just, you're sort of vaguely brownish. That's kind of how it was, like, you're swarthy, you have dark hair, you might have a beard, or at least be unshaven. So you could be a communist, and you might be holding a cartoon bomb. And then when the Bolshevik Revolution happened, you know, the U.S. is about to enter this war. There's already a lot of anti-Russian, anti-Semitism, you know, right around that time. And especially during Prohibition, because again, hey, who drinks? Immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans. Mm-hmm. They make beer. They're clearly communists, too. The Irish, they're drunk. They're communists.
And all of these Catholics coming from these other countries, they're drinkers.
Right.
And who's fighting in church? Right. And who's fighting the temperance war?
That's how they started getting traction. One of the ways they started getting traction, it was that they lumped all immigrants together. They lumped anybody who was an agitator or a radical together. If you were not white Protestant, basically, you were Catholic, if you were black, if you were Jewish, if you were involved in labor unions, if you were an immigrant of any kind... Germans were specifically targeted because of World War I, and they were the enemy. Mm-hmm. Labor union leaders, but anybody who, you know, post-World War I, this was a way for them to say, see, these people are drunks, but they were all involved. I mean, all these immigrants, they came, and they were looking for work, and they worked in the factories, and they were the working class, or the poor. So it was easy to sit for... you know, temperance movement to say, well, we need to do something because they're getting drunk and they're talking about revolution. And the capitalists were like, shit, you know, we don't want our workers revolting. So by 1919, you know, it's like, I was like, where does the bomb thing come from? In 1919, there was an incident with the May Day bombs. Mitchell Palmer, he was an attorney general. him and a bunch of other government officials were sent bombs on May Day in 1919. Everybody was like, see, the communists are taking over. And I'm not sure if it was ever, it's hard to say if it was actually communists or not, or if it was anarchists or if they were combining them.
There was a huge Red Scare where Hoover, prior to being head of the FBI, in a lesser role, had determined that there was going to be a gigantic revolutionary push. All the communists were going to rise up simultaneously and take over all the ports and all the governments and everything and in the U.S. And so they brought out the National Guard. They positioned them in strategic places to prevent the rise up. And
with giant nets.
Yes.
Because, yeah.
State of the art.
And nothing happened.
No, all of it, like the shit that's happening right now. It's like, we gotta stop them from coming into Idaho. Really? Are the terrorists are attacking Idaho?
Yeah.
I don't even know where Idaho is, and I'm an American.
They love potatoes.
Like, right? That's clearly what's happening. But, I mean, that was it. You know, they started just rounding up people. They were like,
it's
you're
an
foreign.
Easy hot button for fear. Like, right. Just plug it and sell it.
And what's funny is that anti-prohibitionists jumped right on this, and they were like, see, actually, Bolshevism, they were using it. They were like, they tried to overturn prohibition or just to slow it down and stop it. They were like, prohibition's un-American, number one, because it's trying to deprive people of their freedom to have beer.
Nice, I like that.
And then they said it was pushing workers towards communism and other radical movements because if they aren't using their free time to drink, they're clearly thinking about communism.
They're in the coffee shops.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Holy shit.
And so it's like,
the dumbest thing you could ever do, USA. Holy crap.
Right. It's like, well, they go to work, and I think even one of the arguments was, well, they go to work, and then they hate their bosses. But then they leave work, and they go have a beer with their friends, and they bitch about their bosses. And then they go home, a little bit drunk, and then they go to work the next day, because they already forgot. Now, they'll hate their bosses, and they'll conspire against them because they don't have any booze to make them forget.
Okay.
It was like, it was such a silly argument, but I was like, that
is it really
the most logical thing I've ever
heard. Really? It seems
the most, you know,
pretty much spot on.
I think it's totally reaching, but I love it. I love that they went there like, I don't know. Let's see if we can use this.
So why is there a cocktail named the Communist?
How does this
fit in?
Going back to people are assholes. I mean, like, really, to me, this is a clear shot at the communists. It's funny, right? It's hilarious. Look, we'll name it the communists because it's red, and look at this mustachioed man who's got a bomb. It's hilarious, right? Communists.
This cartoon
right.
super
I mean,
villain.
They, even the 1930s.
It's going to tie you to the train tracks.
Right. I mean, that's... and so it's like, I think having the cover of all of these rich folk, clearly it's targeted at a particular class, this pamphlet. This wasn't designed by bartenders, like Patrick Gavin Duffy's. Like, his was a bartender book. It was like, here is how you make drinks. Here is how you clean your glasses. Here is how you do this. This was, here, rich folk, you need to know how to make drinks now that Prohibition's over. I know you were hanging out in those speakeasies, but now you can make them at home. And so...
You're right. You could kind of see that they would all be laughing and pointing at the picture of the communists.
Yeah. Oh, it's hilarious!
But I think that it's also interesting because, I don't know if the sentiment changed through Prohibition, but like prior to that, you know, it was kind of a kick for the rich people to go downtown and hang out in the bars with the intellectuals, with the people who were the revolutionaries. You know, remember we were talking about Rudolph Valentino. His first job as a dance instructor, tango pirate.
Nice.
Right? Remember that?
Yeah.
He was getting his work from rich women who'd go downtown, hang out with the poets and the writers and the revolutionaries.
I mean, by the 1930s, like, I was reading this thing where they said some historians call it the Red Decade.
Yeah, okay.
And because it actually, and it makes sense. You have Prohibition happening all through the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the Depression. Tons of people are out of work. And at this point, communism is not, at least in America, it's not about living communally. It's about class consciousness.
Yes.
It's about the working class. And so you have all of these people who are unemployed, all of these people who are sober and can't afford, I mean, they can't afford to go to speakeasies. Maybe they're getting some booze of some kind somewhere. So, I mean, in a sense, they're not sitting in bars. They are thinking, like, what's in it for us? I just see it as, it is like poking fun. This is 1933. It is like 100,000 Americans were members of the Socialist or Communist Party in the 1930s. It's like, you're right, there were people who were like slumming it, and but it might have been fun then because they were there were artists who were communists and writers who were communists.
I think the big thing is that before Russia became a communist state, it was kind of edgy, daring, and right. like little, you know, you're like doing things that are a little bit
naughty.
Iffy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But then when it became real, and you've got revolutionaries around the world saying, our goal is to turn the entire planet into a communist world, that becomes dangerous at that point. That's right. When people are like, oh my God, this is serious.
But what's striking people. To me about sort of the images, the two images of the communist and then the people in tuxedos is it almost speaks to a level of rich that is so far beyond even understanding what's happening. You know, like, oh, there was the rich, and there were rich people who lost all of their money in the Depression. This seems like a level of rich where it's like, oh yeah, I've heard of these communists. What are these workers? What?
Yeah.
Who's what? You know, like, it seems like it's so out of touch that it's cartoonish. It is a cartoon to them. And it's like, ha ha ha, prohibition's over. Communists, remember them? It's like, it's still fucking happening. Like, yeah. they're like organizing throughout the 30s. So in a way, it's like, to me, it seems like there is a disconnect. This isn't the same people who were slumming in the speakeasies. These are people who were could afford to have yeah. booze throughout prohibition.
It's 20 years later.
Yeah.
It's 20 years later, and it's no longer a joke.
Right.
It's.
But they don't even see. It doesn't even. To me, that doesn't seem like they're even scared, or that it's a threat to them. That it's like, oh, that's something that happens in the poor people.
I think I see
people.
The author on the. Oh, Illuminati. Oh, I get it. They're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it is.
Those kooky communists. Yeah. Give me some cherry.
Is that
bounce.
Communist with
Hook
a K?
Me up with a cherry bounce.
I wish I had some cherry bounce. That was
great.
It sounds warm. It sounds
my
like
MC
some
name.
MC Cherry
Bounce.
You could probably make some at home. Yeah. It's just smashed up cherry pits and cherries and sugar and alcohol.
There's a cherry tree next to me.
It's like,
dude,
yeah, from the Ukraine. Isn't that cool? They brought it over from the old country. It's from a farm in Ukraine.
It's a communist cherry tree.
It is a communist, extra red
cherry. 19th century Kool-Aid, Cherry Bounce.
Cherry Bounce.
Well, there it does sound like when you say, you know, add a bunch of sugar, I imagine, yeah, like Kool-Aid packets and a giant. How much sugar? All of it.
All of it. Let's
get it. It'll ferment.
Let's get it bounced.
Okay, well, so is that the full story of the communists?
There's not much to it. I mean, it really is. It only shows up in this one place.
You know what? Else. I think it's really interesting just looking at what the idea of communist meant to cocktail culture, I think is really interesting. I mean, looking at the history and then plugging that back into the United States and thinking, how was this affecting them? And then making a drink named after it. I mean,
you almost think that like some of these bartenders that were around. I mean, at first you could say, well, they missed their shot because it's an easy one. Anything red, you could have been like, it's a communist. Mm-hmm. And they named drinks all kinds of weird shit. But that seems like an easy one that they missed. But it also could be that they were like, I don't need to poke fun at communists. They come into my bar and drink.
Yeah,
you know? Like, right, yeah. They're organized in the back.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And so
they're my best customers.
Right. Yeah. Like, they're here 23 hours out of the day. Yeah. I don't, like, you know, I'm not going to fucking make fun of them. It's like, look, it's red, dudes. Look, red for you. Get it, communism?
This was totally a pamphlet handed out at, like, an Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, I
meeting,
know.
You know, where there's just like, here, take this over here. You know? Or what's that? The Grove? You ever seen that? That whole conspiracy thing?
Uh-uh.
It's like some West Coast place where it's Illuminati. Same, for the United States. Like all the rich folk go and get naked in the woods and
drink communists.
Get weird. Yeah. And drink communists. Yeah. Don't forget your pamphlet.
Like, what the fuck's a communist?
It's obviously a guy with a bomb and black coat and a beard. Obviously.
Just look for that guy.
Yeah. Snidely Whiplash.
Snidely, exactly right.
Well, I guess it's time to go drink a communist.
Just cut one right open.
That doesn't sound right, does it?
Like but a coconut?
We'll go to the bar, order a communist.
Can you have a communist serve it to you? Or drink it off a communist, like a, what do they call this?
Body
like
shots?
Body
no,
shot?
No,
body
like
shot you don't know.
No, we can't have a communist serve it to us. Communism didn't work. It failed.
Newsflash.
There are no
communists. He's saying that for the government listening.
Yeah. We love the USA. It's our homeland.
Okay. Onward.
The Communist Cocktail. 1 ounce Ford's Gin. 3/4 ounce Cherry Hearing. 1 ounce Orange Juice. 3/4 ounce Lemon Juice.
And we are here at the Brixton in Andersonville in Chicago. We're here to try a communist cocktail and see how red it is. Because that's probably why the hell they named it the communist. I'm here with the regular crew. Nicole Pizzini.
Hi, Kim.
Nicole. So, when was it that you became a communist? Just answer the question. You didn't answer the question.
Cam, it was 2009 and I had just graduated college and I moved in with like 10 other people into a commune because it was all we could afford together. We pooled our rent and we all lived in the same apartment in Chicago.
Yeah, college makes people communist.
Yeah.
That's a well-known fact.
I think it was the post-college student debt, no job commune. Yeah.
Okay. I'm also here with Jeremy Fels.
Howdy.
Jeremy, did you become a communist before or after you married a communist?
Well, it was before, but at the very same time as Comrade Nicole.
Also joining us is Mr. Eric Martin.
Hi.
Eric. So, did you become a communist before or after you started loving music?
It was definitely before. It was about 1975, the same time I became a Satanist. And I traveled to the USSR and dug up the corpse of various Soviet leaders and worshipped them while simultaneously worshipping Baphomet just because I was very, very bored on that Saturday evening.
That's bound to happen. That's how many communists start, through the devil. That's well known.
Well, movies weren't good until the 80s, so...
What year did Star Wars come out?
Was it 79?
It was 79.
Ooh.
I said 75.
Oh, yeah, but movies weren't good until the 80s.
Yeah. That's true, but the first one wasn't that great.
No, the first one sucked.
Okay, now we're in truly blasphemous territory.
Okay, so...
It didn't get really good until the Ewoks got involved.
Okay, now we're just trolling.
The first sequence I liked from the whole Star Wars thing was Jabba's Palace. I love that whole sequence. Of course it had something to do with the gold bikini, but not entirely. The whole, like, extravagance thing and the different characters and the different bad guys, I loved it.
I like her bounty hunter outfit.
What?
I like her bounty hunter outfit. When she comes in and her voice is all garbled.
Yeah. That was awesome.
That was
That was very cool.
Know, as an adult, you know, watching the films as an adult is obviously a little bit different. But, you know, in Jabba's Palace, I'm sitting here wondering, like, what the fuck do all these people? They're just hanging out, right? None of them are doing anything.
You've never been to a crack house.
Clearly not. you know, I mean, I thought or, I'd have them doing something.
Or a frat house, for that matter.
Yeah. Well, I didn't look drunk either. So.
Oh, they. Know, well, some of them can't be. I mean, the Ugnaughts had to guard.
Yeah.
And the but, you know, I'm sure that there were plenty of messed up people.
I hope so. I really hope that Jabba's Palace was more interesting than that.
So we're here to try the communist cocktail, which has a tiny bit of reference in, like, it was, what, just a pamphlet. A pamphlet with some cocktails in it, and that's where it comes from.
What year did you say the pamphlet was?
It was in the 30s. So it was, like, after Prohibition, and the way Jay was explaining it, he was kind of like, Prohibition ended, and this printing house was just like, we need to put out something right now. And so there was this series, and he said that a lot of the classics were in it, but then there's this one-off with the cartoon of the guy, the mustachioed Eastern European guy with the bomb.
Please tell me you'll post that.
Yeah, I'll look for it. I think that he might have posted that in the notes that we made. I'll have to make sure that I can pull it. Because, yeah, that's actually a good point.
So is this, I mean, so if someone handed you a pamphlet today with a, you know, a similar cocktail, is that like the ISIS cocktail? Or well, like the Al-Qaeda, I mean, cocktail? What does that look like?
There wasn't like a, there weren't, were there like groups of communists wreaking havoc in Europe at the time?
Oh my God, there were communists everywhere. So like so,
so no communist states. Everyone was like protesting, rallying for communism.
Oh no! But by the 1930s, Russia was well on its way. It was ramping up for World War II. Stalin was already there, and basically the Russian Revolution, 12 million dead, was wrapping up. If it wasn't already over.
Got it.
Actually, I think the purge had already happened, so Stalin had seated himself and was all, everything was nice and tidy. But communism really kind of exploded in the early 20th century.
By that time, China was communist too, wasn't it?
No, China was, China became communist after World War II.
Was it like the 50s, 60s?
There was, I believe there were two leaders in China post-World War II, and they were struggling for power. The U.S. supported Chiang Kai-shek, who was basically the more capitalist, U.S.-friendly guy, and then Mao was the communist one, and more people wanted to go his way. And it's interesting because it seems like that is the story that happened a lot. It's like, well, you could have this other, this way, where we just go back to the way it was, which sucked, or we can try this new thing and see how that goes. And it sounded a lot better, but, like, implementation was an issue.
Fair.
Details are a bitch.
Yeah. Really,
well, my theory is that any system really will work if everybody follows the rules. But there are assholes everywhere, and there are people who don't follow the rules.
Throughout history, like, good luck getting people who have stuff to give up their stuff. Not gonna happen.
There have been cases where people do. It's just, can you sustain it? I mean, it's got to be pretty damn good to, like, lose your yourself into some kind of an organization or group that where you have no real identity anymore.
Or people who have power are not going to give it up lightly.
Yeah, and that's the whole asshole thing. Because, like, there's not supposed to be those people in, but they screw it up. Stalin should have been wearing sackcloth with everybody else.
How strong is this cocktail? Do you know? Is it going to make us lose our sense of individuality?
You know, I think there's quite a bit of juice in it.
It's orange juice?
There's orange juice.
It's supposed to turn red, not orange?
Well, that's, I think, going to be the cherry brandy.
But orange juice is yellow. I mean, it's orange, but it's yellow orange.
Yeah.
It's red, and now it's just going to be sort of like more orange. Right?
If you actually look at the picture, it's not all that red. The name itself kind of befuddles me. I mean, I assume it's supposed to be red. If you're using cherry hearing, then that is a red liqueur.
Does it have, like, beetle shells to give it lots of red coloring?
Well, if it did, not anymore. So, like, so this is cherry hearing. It smells really cherry, and it's an old liqueur.
The bottle says 1818.
But it was in the court in the Netherlands. It was made by a merchant, and he brought it to the royalty, and they sponsored it.
Do they use the pits when they make this?
Yes.
It has that sort of, like, nutty smell.
And if you look at it, it's a deep, rich red. Like fresh blood.
Does it say what variety of cherries they use to make it?
It passes the cough syrup test.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the fear of any cherry anything, is that it's got the cough syrup. But it doesn't. It's like, it's more muted and less sharp than...
I was fully expecting a nose full of Robitussin.
Oh, goodness. Here they have arrived.
Okay. Communist. Pinko. Commie bastard. Bernie Sanders. In each one, I made a couple for you, and each one has an ounce of the Ford's gin, the bartender's gin, as well as a 3/4 ounce of cherry hearing, and then an ounce of grapefruit juice, and then a 3/4 ounce of lemon juice. So there's some acidity in there. The cherry hearing, of course. Did you get that from me? Did you bring your own in?
I brought my own just in case you didn't have any.
I was like, Jesus, I was going to say, you're quick. you know, you start mixing juices and cherry herring, and you get, you know, an interesting color of brown orange, you know? So it's like...
Oh, boy. She's got that look on her face.
This is super delicious. It's just, like, juicy, sweet. Yum. And then that cherry adds a little bit of, like, a candy flavor to the juice.
The bitterness definitely helps balance it out a bit.
So you're tasting cherry?
I'm tasting a little aftertaste of, like, that sort of, like, Smarties kind of aftertaste.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I get that. Absolutely.
Is it like a tart cherry?
No, it's like a Necco wafer. Right? Smarties and Necco wafers are the same, just different sizes. I'm talking about the same stuff here.
I've had Necco wafers before, and I don't remember them being pleasant in any any measure.
That's fair. Yeah. I don't really get Necco wafers either.
Aren't Necco wafers just for like gingerbread house shingles?
Yeah.
Yes. Isn't that just what they're for?
Yes.
I recently built a gingerbread house and used Necco wafers as the shingles, and that is the only thing they're good for. I ate one out of curiosity, and I regretted it.
It does seem like a mistake. Yeah. I mean, I was surprised to find out just now that they actually do have a purpose, other than, like, ruining every Christmas stocking ever, right?
Well, it sounds... But it sounds like Nicole likes Necco wafers.
I just feel a little bit of, like, that dusty sugariness in the aftertaste.
Yeah, it is. It the texture is a little bit dusty that way. You know, I think when you said Smarties or sweet tarts, right? Like that's kind of what it feels like to me.
Compressed powder candy.
Uh huh. Yeah. So I'm getting like fruity, juicy, sort of not quite tropical because you don't have any rum or anything, and then it ends with like a sort of powdered candy.
Yeah, and it's not super. It's not sweet like candy though. You know, it's. I mean, I could drink a whole one of these. Like, you know, you'd be afraid that it could get overly sweet in the way that we're describing it, but that's not the case.
Well, it's not syrupy. It's juicy. It's acidic and bright. Yeah. This is great.
I like it too. It is pretty tart though.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm kind of wondering where the gin went.
Actually, good point. Yeah.
That's fair. I'm not getting gin at all. I'm actually not getting booze at all. It does not taste like alcohol to me.
Did he say what kind of gin he used?
Ford's gin.
The bartender's gin.
Yeah.
He says that every time.
Yeah, it's they're like tagline.
It is, yeah, I must say it's surprisingly brown, right?
Yeah. Probably because it's a pink juice combined with the red.
I have a feeling it would be that way anyway.
It looks a little like a daiquiri because of the juice, because of the sort of, it looks like a rum punch is what it looks like.
I'm disappointed. I don't think this is a true communist in the color.
No, you're right. But, I mean, I don't think orange juice would have made a difference.
I really think that this drink is having doubts about its economic policies. Yeah, it tastes very good.
Yeah, it had to come back to center to get elected, you know.
This isn't primary communist cocktail. This is,
yeah, it's general election.
General election communist cocktail.
This is the Affordable Care Act of cocktails.
Because it's not quite what you expected, and it's fine, you know. It doesn't quite go all the way though.
Most people are gonna like it.
That, well, I mean that. Based on what I've heard from people who've used it, that kind of makes me worry about tomorrow morning after drinking this.
One thing I think this could use from a purely taste standpoint is a little bitterness, more bitter than the grapefruit gives it.
Imagine this without the grapefruit, without the bitter grapefruit.
I think it would be a bit much. I think it needs something bitter or maybe smoky to counteract the acid.
Really?
Smoky. Like instead of gin, maybe a mezcal.
That'd be good.
I may be saying that wrong, but...
Mezcal is kind of hard to cocktail with.
Because it's so smoky.
I know. I've had cocktails, like experimental cocktails, done with mezcal. And a lot of times they taste like a stale ashtray. It's kind of horrifying. It's like, oh God, what did you do?
It's like bartenders use it as a challenge more than anything else. It's like, what can I make with this that doesn't taste terrible? Yeah.
What can I make with mayonnaise?
Well, and we can all agree that it's better than that horrible coffee Patron that was around a few years ago. I don't know if anybody remembers this nightmare.
I missed that.
Yeah, you good. Everybody had one in their freezer, it seemed, and that was probably because it was terrible. It was always full.
You know, I think this really would be good with Chinese food or something similarly fatty.
They're still communists, so...
Or a banh mi.
Oh,
that would be good.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, something kind of spicy, right?
But Vietnam's not communist now.
Yeah, something with cilantro. They were for a while. It still counts. Once you go red, you stay in bed.
Yeah, so Cam, you associate communism with Russia, or the USSR, I guess.
Yeah, generally speaking, Eastern Europe.
And that was mostly over by the time I was aware of the world. And so I associate communism more with China, because they remain communist now. And that's still, like, affecting the world.
That makes no sense to me. And I guess just historically, because, like, the big communist state was Russia, and they were making everybody else communist. They were moving into, making friends with Cuba, that made the whole thing happen there, and then, you know, making friends down in South America, and so it was always there's an entire organization, NATO.
When was the Cuban Missile Crisis? When was that?
62. Don't quote me on that.
It was during. It was during
it was Kennedy. The Kennedy administration. Yeah.
I mean, thank goodness the X-Men put a stop to that.
Yeah. She's right.
We just watched that movie.
Yeah.
The funny thing about this drink, in its relation to the USSR, is that it contains a lot of citrus, which the USSR is not known for.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing the ingredients are probably more prevalent in Cuba or Vietnam.
Actually,
or China.
No, you make a really good point, because one of the things Jay was saying was it was based on the pamphlet art. It was a bunch of idiots just kind of slapping together something. There is nothing about this that is at all communistic.
It's gin.
There is not even vodka in here.
Yeah,
nothing at all. I believe from a different episode, Jay even mentioned how communism chased vodka out of the USSR or out of Russia to bring it to the rest of the world, because prior, it was kind of only a Russian spirit.
So you're saying people who were escaping Russia brought...
Smirnov left Russia because they were turning communist. He needed to get out, and so he did at that time. And he initially went to, I believe, France. But it
he met Mr. Grey Goose?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure that's
Monsieur, Monsieur Goose... he went eventually to the U.S. and I'm not sure. I know Hubline was really responsible for bringing vodka to the United States in the 50s or just prior. And the reason why they did that was because Hubline was associated with the Moscow Mule and popularizing that cocktail. You know, I don't even consider China communist. Especially now, with, like, the way they're, like, rolling over everybody economically and everything.
Yeah, but, like, for example, China took away pretty much all of its religious institutions, artifacts, etc. Like, people go on vacation from China to Taiwan, which they're only recently allowed to do, to, like, go see what their history is. Because that's the only place any of it remains. Like, there was a huge cultural revolution there that is still affecting a lot of people.
I know. And if you've ever read any Chinese literature from the time right after they became communist, you can read an author who wrote a short story prior and then read the same author after, and it's like, oh my God, they took your soul. Because, like, what was acceptable to write was about how a person was struggling with their individuality within the new society and didn't know how to square that with everything, but eventually they would come around and learn how great it was to be a part of the Chinese system and government.
Well, it is, quite frankly. It is one of the best governments in the world. And I would love to live under the Chinese regime and not surf the internet freely. I think that sounds great.
He, for one, welcomes his new Chinese overlords.
They're on their way. You may not realize it, but the U.S. will soon be Chinese.
They beat us all the time. I don't know. This guy on the TV with great hair said that, so it must be true.
You know,
I'm laughing at great hair.
I have a feeling that they're going to be on the decline, especially because, like, they've been kicking our ass in manufacturing forever, but they have a middle class now. The managers of those people come to work in fancy cars and they live in suburban neighborhoods. And it's slowly becoming, the people who work in the factories are slowly becoming aware of this. And they're starting to say, wait a minute, what's this about? And
their response is throwing themselves out the windows of their high-rise, you know, boarding houses. And the response to that is by putting nets below, kind of like trapeze artists use. But
we have lots of disenfranchised, underpaid people here too, and it's hard to make a difference no matter what you're doing, no matter where you are.
All they need is this cocktail, and it'll make all the difference. This is the platform that our candidates should be running on. Drink the communist cocktail, and everything will be okay. You'll be a millionaire tomorrow.
They'd have to call it something else, though. They'd have to call it, like, the freedom cocktail.
I don't think that's how communism works.
I mean, it's just a word. You can make it mean whatever you want it to mean, right?
That's true. I mean,
they did that with socialism.
I declared the word communist to mean lots of money for everybody. Let's start a communist revolution.
What could possibly go wrong? Yeah. China's a weird place, right? They're going to have to decide what kind of country they really want to have. Whether it's going to be communist and everything's going to be centrally planned, or it's going to be capitalist.
The amount of arable land that Russia has is fucking enormous. It's just incredible. And the population has always been just huge. They've been able to sustain themselves through the most ridiculous wars because they only had a gigantic population. And to some extent, you know, it's been a liability as well. It's like, we've got all of these people and we have to sustain them all. We don't have the wherewithal to increase our technology, our innovation, our, you know. There isn't the money and the capacity to give everybody, you know, everything equally.
What's the population density of Russia as compared to other countries?
It's
like, what's the, is there another country that compares? Oh, we should have brought our book.
Russia,
The Economist.
Russia is the largest country by size, land size.
But there's nobody fucking in it.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody wants to live in Siberia.
Yeah, Canada's probably lower density. Because there really isn't anybody in it.
But, and that's because there isn't any kind of tradition there. There isn't, I mean, Native American, but like...
Native Canadian.
North American.
Okay.
First Nations.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, they don't have the density because there isn't the vast amount of people. I mean, remember, all those people came from Asia. They trickled in.
And Russia, like, same area.
Yeah.
I wish I knew the man's name. He just published a book about Hitler. And he said, like, Hitler's end game was actually to take over Russia. It wasn't really to take over Western Europe. He just wanted to, like, fight Western Europe to be like, hey, don't stop me from taking over Russia, and then wanted to expand into all of Russia, so that Germany, like, was the new... Hitler wanted to be the new Ivy, basically. He's like, hey, Germany has all these people, let's just go populate Russia.
What a spectacular failure that was.
Did not go well.
Looking at what Russia had, there's so much land. There's so much you can do with it. I can imagine he was, like, salivating to get it. Stalin just had enough bodies he could throw at the problem until eventually... And that was the same issue in World War I. Was
Napoleon.
What?
Napoleon, too, right? Like, trying to do Russia and just, like, didn't work out.
Yeah. And there was also the issue of the weather. You know, it's...
I think Napoleon just liked those ballet dancers. That's what he was really after.
I believe it.
It's pretty amazing after all that they turned communist.
One story that I heard, and I haven't verified it, but I believe I saw it on the History Channel, and so you know it's true, is that Lyndon Johnson invited Nikita Khrushchev to a world fair kind of thing in the United States. And so this is like modern history. This is like, you know, 50s, 60s. They showed the American home on display with, like, dishwashers, washing machines, all of TVs, and Khrushchev saw it and he left. he just turned around and stormed out. And it was because he thought that it was a lie. That there was no way that every American household had all of these things.
It's still pretty excessive. I mean, if you think about households worldwide, how many have a dishwasher?
Oh yeah, no, there's no question. American, you know, lifestyle is massively excessive. If the whole world lived like we did, it would not be sustainable.
I don't know. I think the dishwasher was one of FDR's new Bill of Rights.
I mean,
it's in there.
Yeah.
A dishwasher in every pot.
Without a dishwasher, our marriage would not be sustainable.
You don't do dishes?
The dishwasher does them.
Yeah, it's for the best.
But the dishwasher can't do all of them.
Yeah, and we do the leftovers.
Do you trade that?
I mean, we lived together many years without one, and he proposed after we got one.
That's false.
That's true.
That is so not true.
That's true. That's actually to your credit that it's not true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there. This, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, is the first time that a man in a marriage has won an argument on tape.
I'm responsible for the dishes in the household, so.
Just as an aside about your crowning achievement of winning an argument, I'm not expecting you to be here next week, just so you know. I'll keep an eye on the news, and
yeah.
I'll call the police if I see anything suspicious.
I would like everyone to know that I do not have life insurance.
Yeah, I actually cannot afford the mortgage without him, so he's safe.
That's good to know. That's...
You don't have life insurance that you know about.
There's that secret policy.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yay, sexism.
So what did y'all think of the Cherry hearing on its own?
Did not like. Although, trying it on its own, I definitely was able to identify it as, like, the powdery candy flavor.
That's the sweet tarts flavor?
Sure.
The color is kind of nice.
Yeah, it's much darker than I thought it would be color-wise.
I really like it. The alcoholic German in my genetic code wanted to drink a lot more than I did.
It's so pretty. I love it. Okay. I don't know. Do you feel good about communism at this point? You done? Are we all done with the communist? What did you think of the communist?
I liked it. It'd go really well with pork loin.
Okay.
Communist pigs.
Yeah.
Oh.
And you, Jeremy?
Yeah, I mean, I'm ambivalent. I don't think it's something I would go out of my way to get. I agree that it could use a little bit more bitter. It wasn't sweet, but it wasn't also not sweet. So, not something I would go for, but it's fine.
So you wouldn't order it?
I don't think so. I think there's a lot of other cocktails that would probably be on the list that would be ahead of this.
And you, Nicole?
It's much more juicy than most of the classic cocktails we try. And juicy without being all lemon. You know, a lot of the cocktails we try is like, oh yeah, this is gin, or oh, whoa, yeah, that's whiskey. This one, it just tasted sort of tutti frutti, which is unusual for classic cocktails.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. But it is post-prohibition, after they discovered juice in order to hide the bathtub gin flavor, so... I guess we will wrap it up. Everyone, go ahead to iTunes and subscribe. If you like this show, tell everybody about it and have them listen. And let's just keep it going because it's fun as hell. Okay, bye now.
Oh, me and my best friends are gonna start a skiffle band. We've learned to play guitars, and we've got a teacher's bass. We're gonna rule the world with our catchy three-chord songs, and all of our girlfriends will be singing along. Sweet. slicking back our hair with wax. In the studio, we're cutting tracks. And we're taking all our trousers to the tailor on the corner, so we can undermine our parents with that hot new stovepipe look. Oh, we're waiting on a call from the major record label, so we can cut ourselves a single, watch it climb up through the charts. Pretty girls and car chases, meeting all these famous faces. When people ask us who we are, and we say we're Karl Marx and the Reds.
Hey everybody, thanks for listening to the Monster in a Glass podcast. I'd like to thank Jason Cruz for researching our content, our regular tasting team, Rachel Rubin, Kevin Rutajczyk, Bethany Lang, and Nicole Pizzini, for joining me in the grueling task of tasting the cocktails we discuss. The Brixton and their bartender, Michael Donnelly, for letting us cavort in their liquid playground, Dan Cruz for art direction and editing, and Mark Piani for the music at the head of the show. Go to blackoverproject.com to see the show archive, become a member, contribute to the project, and get in touch with us. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get the latest news and as it happens updates during live events. And as always, if you're into thinking and drinking, let us blacken your liver.
When people ask us who we are, we say we're Karl Marx and the Reds. Ask us who we are, and we say we're Karl Marx and the Reds.